Hello and welcome to the Book Launch Show. I'm your host, Tim Grawl, and I've been working with authors to help them build their platforms and launch best-selling books for over 10 years. I've launched dozens of best-selling books. They've gone as high as number one on the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post bestseller lists. I've also worked with authors just getting their first books off the ground and out into the world. I've created this show to share the strategies and tactics I've learned along the way. And the last few episodes have been all about the launch of my new book, Running Down a Dream, which just came out. And so in this episode, I wanted to do something a little different. I'm going to share some more stuff in future episodes about how the launch has gone and how I'm going to continue to promote the book. But in this one, I wanted to just give you a preview of the book. So I put together a 30-minute preview of Running Down a Dream. It's the audiobook. It's the first 30-something minutes of the audiobook. And I just wanted to share this with you as a thanks for listening and being a part of my work. If you want a copy of Running Down a Dream, there's a couple ways to get one. The first, of course, is you can go to Amazon and get the Kindle or the print. But also, Steve released his book at the same time. Steve Pressfield released his new book, The Artist Journey, at the same time. And so we're running a special over at blackirishbooks.com where you can get the audiobook and the ebook of both of our books, of both The Artist Journey and Running Down a Dream, for one special price just for the next week. So if you're listening to this, you need to go ahead and go grab a copy of that. You can go to blackirishbooks.com for that. So anyway, without any further ado, here's a preview of my new book, Running Down a Dream. Black Irish Books, LLC presents Running Down a Dream, Your Roadmap to Winning Creative Battles by Tim Grawl, read by me, the author, Tim Grawl, for Candace, Connor, and Max. And the title of this book is inspired by the song Running Down a Dream by Tom Petty, and the passage from the song is, I'm running down a dream that never would come to me, working on a mystery, going wherever it leads, running down a dream. It's dark outside. Late fall, the sun sets earlier and earlier each day. I've always hated this time of year. It's sad. You get up and go to work when it's dark, and it's dark again by the time you get home. I'm home now, sitting at our small IKEA table I use to pay our bills. I take a deep breath as I stare at the check in my hand. The more I look at it, the more despair settles over me. I toss it on the table next to the open envelope torn across my parents' return address and push myself up. I take the 9 steps to join my family in our tiny kitchen in the small house that I can't afford. Candace is standing at the furthest counter, her back to me, preparing dinner. Connor, our 9-month-old, bops around in his jumperoo watching his mom work. I don't say anything. I just stand there, taking it all in. Let's back up 6 months. Everything was pretty close to perfect. I had a day job with great health insurance and paid vacation. I'd also built up my side business to a place where it was bringing in enough money to support us. People around town appreciated my skills too. My uncle-in-law put my name in at his company, one of the best employers in town. They offered me a job with more money, better benefits, and longer vacation. I turned it down because I wouldn't be able to manage my side projects and give my commitment to the corporation at the same time. And then, 2 months after our first son, Connor, was born, Candace and I agreed that I could do the thing I thought everyone else at work was too afraid to do. I turned in my 2 weeks' notice. I would go it alone and build my own thing. I was so proud of myself. All my friends were talking about starting their own businesses and pursuing their dreams, but I was the only one with the guts to do it. Now I was out of money. It wasn't just I, either. We were out of money. We had barely enough in our bank account to pay for food, much less a car payment, mortgage payment, water bill, electric bill, gas bill, and everything else that went into surviving. I pictured us having to move into my in-law's house, and every morning I'd get to have coffee with the man whose daughter and grandson I was too much of a failure to provide for. Desperate, I called my parents and whimpered for help. Could they send me a check out of the money they'd saved to retire? I left the kitchen, went upstairs into our tiny bathroom, closed the door, sat on the toilet, and broke down. What was wrong with me? Why couldn't I do this? Why was I so broken? It wasn't even that something big had gone wrong. I didn't lose my biggest client. There wasn't some big unexpected bill that came along. No, this was on me. Every day I would get up, go into my office, and then waste most of the day playing video games, talking with friends, and avoiding my work. Then as the day neared its end, I'd panic and start trying to get a bunch of work done, but it would soon be time to go home. The entire drive back to my house, I'd feel the shame of wasting another day and make big, bold, audacious promises to myself that tomorrow would be different. But then it wasn't. Stack up enough of these useless days and you have a bunch of clients that are mad because their work isn't done. And when you don't do your work, the clients can't get billed. Soon you don't have any money coming in. Your bank account runs dry. You've put yourself in a place that forces you to call your parents to ask them to send you a check because you're going to miss a mortgage payment if they don't. Which leads to a truly horrifying realization. I'm a broken down mess. In Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art, the artist is anyone taking an idea in her head and bringing it forth into the material world, be it a novel or a sculpture or even a plumbing supply business. He also goes on to define the attacking force that keeps us from delivering on the promise we make to ourselves, resistance with a capital R. He says, resistance is a repelling force. It is negative. Its aim is to shove us away, distract us, prevent us from doing our work. In one of my motivated states late in the day at my desk, I got around to finally reading Pressfield's book. In my turmoil on the toilet, I realized that I was resistance's plaything, stuck and oblivious to its power. And it seemed like the harder I rallied to get a grip on it, the further I slipped into its abyss. The most devastating line for me in The War of Art is the fourth sentence on the last page of the book. In speaking on the artist's life, Pressfield says, quote, do it or don't do it. I thought about that line, and the only thought in my head was, but what if I can't? I had so many things inside of me that I wanted to let out. I wanted to write. I wanted to build a business. I wanted to speak. I wanted to teach. I wanted to use what was inside of me to make this world a better place. I desperately wanted to do it, but I just couldn't. I was stuck. And I felt so much shame, resentment, and jealousy when I looked at the world around me. Every book or article I read seemed to be filled with people making big leaps to pursue their dreams and succeeding. Why couldn't I do that? What was wrong with me? So I stayed alone on the toilet crying and thought it through. I knew I was broken. There was something about me that just couldn't let me do all these things I wanted to do. But I had an escape hatch. There was an easy way out of this mess I had created. I had a degree in computer science, also paid for by my parents, and was a pretty good software developer. I could go back to the big company that offered me the big job I had turned down and tell them I've had a change of heart. If that didn't work out, I could maybe go back to my old job that wasn't as big of a deal but honorable and reliable and see if they would take me back. Either way, I was sure I could find a job that would give me a steady paycheck, a paid vacation, a 401k, and decent health insurance for my growing family. The tears stopped flowing and my breathing wasn't so labored anymore. My other option was to double down on my failure and try to figure out how to fix myself. I could go deeper into this thing and see if there was a way to get myself out of this hole and start achieving some of those dreams I had. So, I guess Pressfield was right. Only my options were reversed. He said do it or don't do it. In this case, don't do it meant going back and getting my old job. I realized it wasn't about can't. I wasn't being physically restrained from making a decision, and there was no law that stopped me either. That's a powerful thing to understand. I had a choice. I was going to do it. I'd face daily resistance head on and fix my broken self by bringing my ideas into the material world as best I could. And I knew it would be okay if I didn't do it too. If everything fell apart completely, I'd retreat and regroup. I'd use a valuable skill I had to stockpile some money and buy me some time to do it again down the road. This is where most stories about successful people end. The artist decides, I'm going to do it. She readies her souls, dons the armor, and sets out to vanquish the dragon. She's on a mission and nothing will stop her. It wasn't like that for me at all. Even though I decided to do it, I still saw myself as broken and pathetic. Those steps down the stairs to rejoin my family in the kitchen were the first steps of a marathon I was woefully unprepared to run. I wasn't starting a journey that would be solved over the next days, weeks, months, or even years. I didn't even know I'd begun a marathon, but I did start. I was going to run down this dream or collapse in its pursuit. And if I collapse, I'd get up, rest, and then get back out there again. And boy, would I collapse. A lot. In my future was a personal mental breakdown, a sheriff showing up at my house with a subpoena from the IRS, a marriage that teetered toward divorce, and too many other descents into darkness to count. But also in my future was becoming one of the most successful marketing professionals in my industry, publishing a book that sold tens of thousands of copies, working with my heroes, speaking in front of thousands of people, and making more money off my creativity than I ever thought possible. It culminated into a moment where I found myself at a rooftop bar in downtown Portland and realized I had done it. I had caught that dream I had decided to run down so many years before, for better or for worse. I want to share with you my pursuit of fixing myself. This is my story to the best of my recollection. I'll start at the beginning, full of dreams but stuck in making no progress, and show you how I've reached those dreams. This isn't going to be some big picture, high-minded, philosophical journey. I know that's not my gift to deliver. As we'll see, I'm an obsessive, in-the-trenches grinder. I don't have many big ideas, but I can dig in and learn the skills and tools I need to succeed. So I'm going to make this process very practical. When you go to the doctor with a broken leg, you're not interested in him talking about the history and philosophy behind the practice of medicine. You want him to fix your leg. So if you're like me and you feel broken because no matter how much you want to pursue your dreams, you just can't ever seem to get there, this is the book for you. I've come to believe two simple principles about achieving success in creative pursuits. First, every single problem is fixable. There is nothing unique about your brokenness. No matter how or why you are broken, there is a way to overcome it. And two, success is inevitable if you keep moving. The only thing that matters is that you keep going. The only way to truly fail at a marathon is to stop taking the next step. Sometimes you're running, sometimes you're walking, and sometimes you're crawling. It doesn't matter. If you're moving forward, you will succeed. Now, once you reach that success, you'll discover something truly unexpected, but we'll address that later on. For now, your only job is to commit to going on this journey with me and to keep moving forward. I'm going to ask you to do some hard, uncomfortable, and occasionally weird things, but if you do them, you can beat resistance and achieve your dreams. Let's get started. Book 1. First Principles: Crawling from the Wreckage. A magical victory for me would be the ability to pay my bills. It's all well and good that I made a conscious decision to press forward and pursue my dreams. I postponed a tail between my legs phone call to my former 9-to-5 employer, but the reality of that dark night of the soul bathroom moment still remained. I'd solved none of my problems. The dragon held all of the treasure. I was still out of money. But on the plus side, I had a lifeline check for my parents in hand. I had a couple of options here. I could deposit the check and catch up on some of my bills, but that would only postpone the problem and put me into even more debt. My other option was to see how fast I could turn things around. I called my bank to find out how late I could pay my mortgage, and I took a look at my other bills. I came up with 9 days. 9 days before things got really bad. 9 days to get some money in the bank before credit ratings would go down and creditors would start calling. 6 months ago, I had developed a plan and convinced Candace, the smartest and strongest person I know, that I could do this. I blew a lot of that trust, but I had 9 days to turn things around. My plan was to continue to build up my creative projects while doing freelance web development work to pay my bills. I had let a ton of that work fall behind, which put me into my current predicament. I had no money coming in because I couldn't bill for work I hadn't completed yet. One solution to my problem would be to simply finish the work I had, bill for it, and then collect the fees and pay my bills. So the next question would be, how long would it take for me to do the work I'd been putting off? Conservatively, I calculated that it would take me far longer than 9 days to finish the current work, bill, and book the cash. So that wasn't going to solve my problems today without me having to cash my lifeline check. I set that answer aside knowing that would be plan B and kept thinking, how could I possibly pull in cash without having to stay up for 9 days in a row working? The way my consulting worked was, 1, someone would contact me. 2, I would talk with them about what services I provided and then I'd send them a proposal for the work. 3, if they agreed to the proposal, they'd sign my contract and send me a down payment so I could begin the work. So, if I were able to get a bunch of brand new clients in the next 9 days, I could stockpile a bunch of down payments directly into my bank account. This would forestall cashing that check from my parents. I needed to figure out how to get a lot of clients fast. My current runway for making things work measured in days, not weeks or months. I started coming up with all these elaborate plans. I thought about buying advertising or maybe writing some guest articles on web development websites. At this time, my office was a small closet with no windows at my church. The day after my breakdown, my friend Matt stopped by the church and we started chatting. Matt is one of those embarrassingly smart guys. My parents paid a university tens of thousands of dollars to teach me computer programming. At the same time, Matt was going to the local bookstore. He would buy a coffee, pull the computer programming books off the shelf, and teach himself the same stuff for free. He wasn't there yet, but in a few years, he would found a software company worth millions. I admitted my situation to Matt and told him about my ideas for getting more work. He blinked a couple of times and stared at me. Those are horrible ideas. Matt was not known for his finesse. Okay, what should I do? I said. What do you need? Clients? Right. What's the best way to get clients? Thought for a second. Referrals? I said, a bit unsure. Exactly. Where do you get referrals most often? Past clients. There you go, he said. Send an email to every client you've ever done any work for and tell them you're looking to pick up some more work. Okay, I can do that, I said. I went back into my office and wrote a list of every client I'd done work for over the last few years. Then I typed up a simple email to each of them. I told them I was looking to pick up some more work and was wondering if they needed anything. If not, could they give me the names of anyone they thought could use my help? As I thought back through my conversation with Matt, I figured out what he was trying to teach me. Always find the direct route. Look for the shortest path between A, where you are, and B, where you want to be. I tend to fill my problems with unneeded complexity and junk that just takes up space. Most problems don't need an elaborate solution. Most problems are simple. Within 3 days, I was flush with new clients. They paid me deposits on the work, and I was able to pay my mortgage and catch up on my other bills. I couldn't believe it. It seemed so easy. I didn't have to deposit that lifeline check from my parents, but my problems weren't over. I'd slapped a temporary cast on a problem that ran far deeper than I imagined. What are you doing all day? I was back in the hole again. After turning things around a few months before and getting caught back up on bills, we were coming up short again. Candace had gone to the grocery store, filled a cart with groceries, and tried to check out. Her debit card came up rejected. Our bank account was overdrawn again. As the checker, bagger, and other people in line watched, Candace picked up Connor out of the cart and carried him to the car, leaving the groceries behind. What are you doing all day? She asked me when she got home. I gave all the excuses. I was working hard, but projects weren't getting finished, so I couldn't invoice. I'd been trying to find new work, but it wasn't coming in. Clients were late paying their bills. But the truth was, I didn't know what I was doing all day. I would go into the office at 8 and be there for 9 hours, but somehow I wasn't making enough money. Sure, I was wasting time here and there. I would play video games a little bit. I'd surf the internet. I'd chat with my buddy Dan, who worked down the hall. But all that was normal. After this conversation, though, I got curious. I heard about this software you could install on your computer that would track everything you were doing all day. It tracked what applications you were using, what sites you were visiting, etc. It also categorized everything so you could see what percentage of time you were working and not working. I installed it on a Monday morning, and when I looked at the report on Friday, I was appalled. That little bit of time I was playing video games was almost 10 hours over the course of the week. That normal web surfing was another 15. Chatting with Dan? Well, it couldn't track that, but it did track times my computer was idle during work hours, and that was another good chunk of time. I was at work, but I wasn't working. I realized that my excuse of being too busy wasn't real. Another freaking lie. I wasn't too busy. Then I started thinking of all the other areas of my life. How much television was I watching? How much time was I wasting reading about working instead of working? What were my frequent coffee breaks to chat with Dan costing me? I realized that this idea of too busy was a big fat lie. Saying I was too busy was offloading the responsibility from me. The truth is, I have a huge amount of autonomy over my life. Almost everything in my life is something I choose to have in my life. Everything from small things like buying a cup of coffee and avoiding work for an hour, to big things like being married and buying a house. These are all choices I have made and continue to make. If I'm ruthlessly honest, there is almost nothing in my life that I don't have complete control over. Things like my race and some health problems are set. Otherwise, everything else is a choice. I can choose what to eat. I can choose where to live. I can choose what I spend my time on. I could even choose whether or not I want to stay with Candace and Connor. And yet, every time I make the argument that I'm too busy, I'm acting as if this is something that happened to me instead of something I've chosen. So I made a change. From then on, anytime the phrase, I'm too busy to, popped into my head, I'd change it to, I've chosen not to prioritize. Now instead of thinking, I'm too busy to write today, I think I've chosen not to prioritize writing today. Instead of telling a client that I was too busy to get to their project, I told them that I had other things I had to prioritize ahead of them. The first thing that happened when I started doing this was a complete shock to my psyche. I was devastated by what I saw. Now when I look back on a day at work when I didn't get anything done, I had to admit that I prioritized so many things above things I said were important to me. Then the natural next step was to start shaming myself. How could I be so stupid? How could I be so wasteful with my time? There's that resistance coming forward again. Be forewarned, he's a nasty sucker who will do anything, anything to get you to quit your forward movement. I immediately pushed back from this. I couldn't turn it into a moral life sentence judgment on myself, even if it was accurate at times. At this point, it was useless to start labeling things as right and wrong or good versus bad way of spending my time. My goal was to pay my bills and take care of my family without having to cash my parents' check or go back to work for someone else. But right now, it was just about seeing the truth. The important thing to remember was that, yes, some things are more important than other things. I had to focus on what those things were to me without getting all intellectual about it. When Connor was up all night screaming and crying, helping Candace was a higher priority than getting a full 8 hours of sleep. But binge watching my favorite television show probably wasn't. At this point, though, looking at my situation with open eyes and forcing myself to see the truth about how I was spending my time was the first step. Only after that could I actually do something about it. Seeing my time-wasting data wasn't enough. Admitting to myself how much time I was wasting during the day was enlightening, but not a lot changed. I uninstalled World of Warcraft from my computer so I couldn't play it during office hours, but I burned that time doing something else. My tiny little tweaks weren't enough to break the macro habit. I needed a shock to the system, something that would force me to change my deeply entrenched behavior. I needed to cut out all this useless crap out of my life that was keeping me from doing my work. This would force me to sit down and make progress. So I got a piece of paper and a pen, and I wrote down everything I did in a day. Everything. All the tiny minutia like going to the bathroom, driving to work, and making lunch. I included eating dinner with family, making client calls, and watching TV before bed. It all went down in one giant list. Then I went straight down the page and started crossing stuff off. Here is a criteria and value structure I used to whittle my life down to its core. If I didn't need it to survive or keep my family's life going, it got crossed off. So using the bathroom didn't get crossed off. Eating dinner with my family, picking up groceries, making a client phone call, that all stayed. But watching TV, reading the news, checking my favorite websites, listening to music in the car, getting coffee with Dan, that all got crossed off. Then I rewrote the list. I only kept the stuff that was important to the survival of my family. I lived like that for 1 week. For 7 days, I didn't do anything that wasn't necessary in my life. I didn't read novels, I didn't exercise, I didn't idly surf the internet, I didn't watch TV. This was hard. More than hard, it was excruciating. I ran out of stuff to do at work by noon. I found myself sitting upstairs on the bed by myself at 7:30 p.m. because Candace was watching TV downstairs, and I was staring at the floor because I had nothing to do. I did this for 7 days. Somewhere in that week, I snapped. I finally understood how much all this useless stuff was crowding my life. And not just my life, but my mind. It's no wonder I couldn't concentrate on anything. It's no wonder I couldn't get anything done. I was so jacked up all the time with stuff that didn't help me achieve any of my goals. It all kept me distracted from my primary responsibilities as a husband and father. It was like constantly eating candy and never being hungry for real food. Now, of course, this is no way to live. I don't want to live my life where I never go out with friends or on a date with my wife or read a novel. But ever since doing this, I look at all those things differently. Their value has risen. Over the months that followed this week, I came to realize two things. The first is that I wasn't taking a radical or ruthless enough approach to change. I was constantly making bargains and pacts and capitulations. I would compromise and cajole. Resistance thrives in that gray zone of valueless non-judgment. It loves instant gratification and rationalizing that I could do it tomorrow. I was this broken mess of a man, and resistance loved that about me. It convinced me that it was better to make small incremental changes instead of burning myself out by making big changes. Months ago, when I was sitting with that check in my hand trying to figure out if I should give up or keep going, I made a difficult decision to pursue a dream. The problem was, a decision doesn't actually fix anything. Only our actions do. I had to make a change, and I was in a position where slow incremental change wasn't good enough. The first lesson I learned during this week of empty time was to be ruthless with myself in my pursuit of my dream. Having pity and compassion for the broken parts of me would only keep me sitting still. I had to move and move quickly. I had to recognize a lie that the nice voice of resistance in my head as quickly as I recognized the nasty one. This reminder way station serves me well to this day. The second lesson I learned was actually a lesson my dad had been trying to teach me since I was 6 years old. When I was 6 years old, my dad got his dream job. He moved our family to Georgia so he could take the position. It wasn't a big-time corporate job. It wasn't working for his favorite company of all time. It was a little Debbie snack cake distributorship. If you've ever walked into a gas station or grocery store in the United States, I'm sure you've seen them on the shelves. My dad is the guy who sells them to the stores and stocks the shelves. He loves the job because he gets to be his own boss. He makes his own hours, works the way he thinks is best, and is directly rewarded for how hard and smart he works. Several years after taking this position, a curious thing started happening. Little Debbie managers started flying in from all over the country to spend a day riding around with my dad to watch him work. You see, my dad had become one of the top 5 Little Debbie distributors in the United States. And he was the only one in the top 50 who didn't have a full-time or part-time employee. He did it all by himself. The managers were flying in from all over the country to see how this one man was able to output so many Little Debbies in so little time. When he first got the job, they trained him on the right way to sell Little Debbies. They taught him where to park the truck, how to pull the orders, how to interact with the store managers, how to stock the shelves, and so on. This system was based on years of training Little Debbie distributors all over the country. Pretty quickly, my dad started seeing some problems in how they did things. Maybe not problems so much, but definitely big inefficiencies. And inefficiencies cost money. My dad had always wanted a job like this. It put the power in his hands for how hard he worked and how much money he made in the process. If you could do something faster, or better yet, stop doing something and still get the job done, that means you can sell more Little Debbies in less time. Selling more in less time means my dad made more money every day. So instead of parking around the side of the building, he parked right out front so he didn't have to walk as far. Instead of showing each individual item to the store managers, he would do inventory in bulk. Instead of taking out all the snack cakes and putting them on the shelf by hand, he would simply take the top off the box and put them on the shelf still in the box. And then he stopped taking the tops off himself. Instead, he paid a couple of teenagers to do it for him on the weekends. Each elimination of inefficiency shaved off more and more time. Pretty soon, he was servicing 4 times as many stores in a day than the other Little Debbie distributors across the country. The higher-ups in the company flew in to see it for themselves. Here's the craziest part of this whole thing, though. Nothing changed at Little Debbie. Even now, the way my dad does things has not spread to the other distributors. Most of them still follow the same rules and practices that were taught to them without question. Constantly trimming away inefficiencies in the way you work is a powerful tool. What's even more powerful is that very few people have the discipline to do it. I certainly didn't have it. And until I discovered how incredibly inefficient I was, chances are I would never obtain the knowledge my dad modeled every day. After that week of cutting all that stuff out of my life, I didn't keep living like a monk. I allowed myself to have some fun things, but many of those things I had cut out of my life, I kept out. For instance, I stopped updating social media sites, and I stopped going to the weekly networking group I had been attending. I cut way back on the TV I was watching and stopped making so many coffee meetings. Here's what's amazing. Nothing bad happened. Not a single thing. This stuff I had felt a constant compulsion and need to do. Once cut out, I realized there was no need for it. It didn't add anything useful to my life. I have found this to be true for most things I've taken for granted. I had these stories in my head that I needed to do something to prevent bad things from happening. I never stopped to question those things until I saw just how much time I was wasting. So I started questioning everything. I looked hard at everything I was spending my time on and questioned if it really had to be done, or if I even wanted to do it, or if anything bad would actually happen if I stopped. This is not easy. In fact, it took me years to obliterate a deeply ingrained story inside my head. A few years after my monkitude, I was running a busy consulting firm. I'll get into how this happened shortly. I was working with authors to help them market and launch their books, and it was going well. Connor, my oldest son, was 5. Candace had decided to homeschool him and I wanted to help. I wanted to start taking off Friday so I could teach him science or blow stuff up in the backyard. But I was afraid. I had clients who needed to talk to me. I had work that needed to be done. The normal work week is 5 days, so I needed to work 5 days. But did I? Did I really have to work 5 days a week? Where did this rule come from? Is this something written in stone somewhere? So I decided to opt out, but only as a test. I decided for a month I would take Fridays off. I focused on getting my work done in 4 days instead of 5, and when my clients asked to talk with me on Friday, I said I was busy but could talk Thursday or Monday. And what happened? Nothing. Not a single bad thing happened. So I decided to take another month of Fridays off, and so on, and now I don't even think about working on Friday. It still amazes me that a single week of cutting stuff out of my life radically changed the way I see the world. I started getting good at keeping all the unessential stuff out of my life. I cut way back on how much time I was wasting on video games, chatting with friends, and watching TV. It opened up all this space in my workday that had never been there before. And honestly, I thought I had won at this point. I thought I had finally fixed that broken part of me that was causing me so much trouble. How naive I was. Now that I wasn't wasting my time anymore, things seemed to get better. I stopped running out of money every month, but another problem started cropping up. Even though I was doing a lot more work during the day, money was still uneven. I'd still have these stretches where my bank account would be running disastrously low. I decided my problem was I needed help. If I had someone working with me, I could finish projects faster, which meant I could send final invoices faster. So I convinced a friend of mine, Joseph, who was just like me when I started, married with a newborn, to leave his stable full-time job and come work for me instead. Poor bastard. I thought for sure having an employee would allow me to take on even more paying work and therefore make more money. Reasonable assumption, right? Instead of helping, though, it intensified my problem. Now I had an entire second family relying on my business skills, which were proving to be very shaky at best. My stress level began to spike in two-week cycles based on our payroll schedule. Now, if I didn't have enough to run payroll, it didn't just affect me, it affected Joseph and his family too. And that's much harder to hide from. Adding new responsibility increases the chance for both new opportunities and bigger obstacles. I lost count of the number of times I would go to the post office box the day before payroll was due, put my key in the lock praying that checks had shown up. I would often drive to the post office many times a day to check for mail. My hatred of any junk mail grew exponentially. Every time I saw an envelope in the box, my hope would soar for those few seconds. Then I saw it was another offer for a credit card. More than once, I had to tell Joseph that I would be late paying him. Not cool. This was a problem that the check my mother and father sent me to make my mortgage wasn't going to solve. One morning, the weight of carrying two families on my shoulders came to a fever pitch. I had gotten up and gotten ready for work the same as most mornings. Actually, this day was a bit different. Usually, since I didn't have clients in the office and I worked for myself, I just wore a t-shirt and jeans into the office. But today I was feeling good. I wanted to dress up a bit. So I put on a nice pair of pants and a button-up Oxford shirt. I was just about ready to go when my phone notified me that a new email had come in. I checked it to find an email from a client saying that he wouldn't be able to pay their invoice that month. It was a big invoice. It was due and I was counting on that money to make the next payroll. I put the phone down with shaky hands and stood for a moment. My mind churned on what to do next. I rifled through my mind, desperately searching for a contingency plan, but I kept coming up empty. I sank to my knees and tears welled. My body continued to shake and I folded over into the fetal position. I felt like the pressure in my head was going to pop. I lay there shaking. I wasn't sure how long. It was like my mind shut down. I waited for a reboot. I felt like I was constantly pushing and running as hard as I could, but nothing was ever good enough. Nothing was working. How in the hell did I move from feeling strong and successful one second into a pit of despair the next? I lay there a while until the shaking stopped. I felt like I could get back to my feet. I stumbled to the bathroom and looked in the mirror. Red and purple streaked across my forehead and cheeks where the blood vessels had burst. This position I found myself in was even worse than when I had to ask my parents for money. What the hell? Back then, I knew what the problem was. I had to crack down. I needed to figure out how to actually work and stop wasting so much time. And through great effort, like crazy effort that left me twiddling my thumbs on my bed at 7 p.m. at night for a week straight, I got my act together and consistently met my responsibilities. But now I didn't even know what to do next. I felt like I was doing everything I knew to do and it wasn't good enough. I'd beaten resistance, hadn't I? I was doing my work just like Steve Pressfield said I should do, yet still I was here freaking out in the bathroom. There's a special kind of desperation and shame that falls on you in these moments. When you know what you're supposed to be doing and you're not doing it, at least there is some control. You know if you can just get yourself moving, you can fix things. This realization is, believe it or not, more devastating. I thought I had fixed myself, took everything I had to root out of my problem of wasting so much time, but now I ran into a new way of being broken and I had no idea what it was. It was like being sick, going to the doctors, and they couldn't figure out what it was. That's a different kind of fear than having a diagnosis, even if it's a bad one. It's a complete unknown slap in the face. As I cleaned myself up the best I could do, made my way down to the office, I made a decision. I needed to talk to someone who knew things I didn't know. The chances that I was the only person on the planet to confront this sort of cash flow problem were pretty small. In fact, a few months before this punch to the gut, I had met a guy named Josh Kaufman. He ran a site called The Personal MBA and was a business coach. We had corresponded a bit, but I had never really told him how things were going in my business. Why? I was embarrassed. Who wants to tell a smart guy that you're stupid? However, it was time to let that go. My personal humiliation was nothing in the face of Joseph not being able to feed his family because of my pride. I shot Josh a quick email. Quote, I'm seriously in need of some regular ongoing business coaching. I'm trying to make some changes and progress in my business and constantly don't know what I need to do or how to focus my resources. Do you have room in your schedule for me? What is your monthly fee? He replied back that his fee was $797 a month. What? I stared at that email for a long while. I couldn't even make payroll. I didn't have an extra $800 lying around every month. But I had this intense feeling that I was slowly circling the drain. Even when money was coming in, I was able to easily make payroll and my other bills. I didn't feel like I was getting ahead. I felt like it was just putting off my inevitable demise. So I took a deep breath, sent Josh my credit card information, and scheduled our first call for the next day. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Book Launch Show and the excerpt of my new book, Running Down a Dream. As I mentioned, you can get the book in Kindle or print over at Amazon.com. And we are running a special over at blackirishbooks.com where you can get the ebook and the audiobook of both my book and Stephen Pressfield's new book, The Artist's Journey, for one special price. So that's only available for another week. So make sure you go and grab a copy of that. For all the past episodes or the show notes or to connect with me, you can go to booklaunchshow.com. I have dozens of free book marketing resources and articles that you can access at my website, booklaunch.com. Lastly, if you would like to support the show, you can do that by telling another author about the show and by visiting us on Apple Podcasts and leaving a rating and review. Thanks for subscribing and being a part of our work here at booklaunch.com. I'll see you next time.